Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Never mind that Barack Obama has never set foot in Ghana. The country's message for the first African-American president is welcome home. The greeting springs from the hope that Obama will help lift his late Kenyan father's whole continent from the depths of conflict and poverty. The president and his family arrive in Ghana tonight. He will address the country's parliament tomorrow. Joseph Warren is editor of the BBC's Focus on Africa program, and he joins us now from London. Joseph, these expectations for just how much Obama can do for Africa, are they too high?
I think there are people thinking that now that we've got someone who can trace his lineage back to Africa, that this is going to be good for Africa, that we might perhaps have a favorable U.S. policy, foreign policy on Africa. But on the other hand, President Bush did do quite a lot for Africa, did invest quite a bit in the fight against HIV/AIDS, so that raises the bar even higher.
Well, actually, President Obama has his critics. Paul Zeitz, who's executive director of the Global AIDS Alliance, says Obama has broken his promises to Africa when it comes to funding for HIV/AIDS and malaria.
The feeling is that we haven't seen the fullness of his policy on HIV yet, but the thinking is that Bush was absolutely committed to the fight against malaria and HIV/AIDS. You know, there was millions and millions of dollars devoted to this campaign. You actually see it on the ground, but we didn't see very pronounced pledges from Obama in terms of this is how much money I want to put towards this. I suppose that's what we might expect on Saturday when he gives his actual address.
What's the significance of the choice of Ghana for President Obama's African visit?
I should tell you, first of all, that it's caused a lot of grief around Africa from Kenya, for example, where they were thinking, oh, you should come here first.
Because his father was born there.
Exactly. Or from Nigeria, which is Africa's biggest country with the biggest population. But I suppose there's a rational choice for Ghana. Ghana has just had an election at about the same time that President Obama was elected. There's a new administration. It's had a history of military rule, and then it went into democratic transition. And the last election in December was very, very close. And there was a real opportunity for the country to sink into violence. But they rose up to it and said, you know what, we're going to move on. So there's Ghana has, in a sense, got good democratic credentials. The other reason, I suppose, is Ghana springs to mind, especially for Americans, as a country that people look back to, especially African Americans, in terms of one of the origins of slavery. So it's got that as well. So to speak, Ghana has got, in quotes, a clean democratic credential. And that's what Obama wants to push across, that Africa, you know, needs to sort out its democratic transitions.
In fact, in Ghana, there's a place that's become quite a tourist destination for African Americans, and I'm sure Africans from around the world, because it's a place where slaves embarked on their trip to other places. I'm sure we'll see him taking in some of these sites. And of course, you mentioned that Ghana, as Obama said before the trip, has a history of good governance, as opposed to Kenya, where hundreds of civilians were killed after those ethnic clashes following the disputed 2007 vote. But I'm wondering, too, Ghana is expected to start pumping oil in 2010. And we're wondering, do you think Obama's taking a page from China's playbook, China pushing its oil and other business relations on the continent?
Absolutely. I think that's the unspoken reason, A, why he's going to Africa and why he's chosen Ghana. You know, their huge oil reserves. China has made huge inroads in Africa in securing both mineral and other natural resources. And very recently, we had the Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, who also visited a few countries who've got, big oil reserves. So there is a feeling that America as well needs to be out there in securing its place in terms of energy supplies.
Well, Joseph, we should say it's been a lot of fun reading the Africans weighing in on the BBC blogs. As you said, Ghanaians with so much pride, others, Nigerians, wondering why not us. But everybody agreeing that while this is President Obama's first visit to sub-Saharan Africa, he did pass through Egypt, many saying, well, he didn't bring Michelle Obama, so it doesn't count.
Yes, and she's got a lot of fans. I should tell you that it's going to be quite a colourful visit. In a sense, there are functions which are set aside. And in Cape Coast, for example, that slavery port that we were talking about earlier, the first family will visit. But there's a bit of frustration, though, that there isn't a much bigger opportunity for him to have a huge rally out in the open where people can see him in the flesh, can see Michelle. It's quite restricted, unlike his other visits to, say, Germany, for example. So that's a source of some frustration in Ghana.
Joseph Wanengu, editor of the BBC's Focus on Africa, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Many thanks.
Are you looking for a book to bring to the beach, the lake, or hiking? How about Beowulf? Ah, Beowulf, the second biggest stud in literary history after Achilles, according to our next guest. But if 10th century Anglo-Saxon poetry is not up your alley, how about James Joyce's Ulysses, the Citizen Kane of English language novels, or 100 Years of Solitude, the singular masterpiece of the second half of the 20th century? In fact, one thing all of these books have in common is that they are considered among the best books ever written, but they're rarely read. Well, our next guest makes the case that if you know what to skip, you could make them beach chair companions. His new guide is called Beowulf on the Beach, What to Love and What to Skip in Literature's 50 Greatest Hits. And Jack Murnahan, who has a doctorate in medieval and Renaissance literature and teaches writing at the University of the Arts in New York, joins us from the Argo Network studios in Manhattan. Jack, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to speak to you.
Do people say to you what you're kidding, A Farewell to Arms or Kafka's The Trial or Middlemarch, George Eliot? Nobody reads those books.
It is true, and it's sort of sad. That's why I wrote this book, to try to reorient people away from magazines and lesser fiction and try to get them to read some really good things that will surprise them.
Well, and everybody has different opinions of the list. So, for instance, I completely understand Tolstoy's Anna Karenina or Nabokov's Lolita. But Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, it's in 14th century English. Our producer, Emiko Tamagawa, is one of legions who had to memorize the opening lines of the Canterbury Tales, I think, Emiko, 20 years ago, and she still remembers them. Let's listen.
One that April with his shurus sought, the drought of March hath pierced to the rot, and bothered every vein in switch liqueur, of which vertu engendered is the floor.
Not all the Canterbury Tales are going to be especially fun to read at this point, but some of them might surprise you as being among the funniest and maybe even sexiest things that you've ever read. You read something like The Wife of Bath, and she talks about how she's put five husbands in the grave by having too much sex with them, and that she just wants to have a young one who stays fresh in the bed, always gives her what she wants, and that she's going to have dominion over him by allotting out how much pleasure he's allowed to have. Kind of feminist, kind of modern, right?
Yeah, well, and it also is like the part of the book that someone might want to get to real fast, and so.
Indeed, yes, and you're allowed to skip some of the religious sermons. I let you know which pages those are, so you can bypass those.
Well, yes, you have these different segments, so that they're a guide to what to look for. One of the segments is what's sexy in a book. So, for instance, in Madame Bovary, the erotic description of sweat on Emma Bovary's shoulders. Quirky Facts is another segment. Of Kafka, you write that he died at 40 of starvation, of illnesses that made his throat so sore he couldn't swallow. And as you write, that's awful. What is it about these little quirky facts that you think opens the door to some of these books?
Well, I think that at the end of the day, people want to be able to remember trivia about things. And I figure if you never make it around to reading the Kafka, you'll always remember that fact, right? Or if I tell you that there's a character in Faust that's a hermaphroditic bit of flame trapped in a test tube, that you'll remember.
Well, yeah. And another thing that you let us in on, though, is what to skip. And in Moby Dick, for instance, that would be pretty much all the chapters on whaling.
No. Only a little bit. Only a tiny bit.
Okay. Well, but what do you say to those who say even that is heresy? You know, every word of a great book should be read.
I hope those people don't have children that they're ignoring, or lovers that they're not listening to, or other things that they're not tending to, because, I read all these books, and I read them multiple times and very, very carefully, but it takes a long, long time, and you can't expect people with normal lives and normal jobs to be able to read, say, all 3,300 pages of the Proust. But if you read 1,800 pages of the Proust, you're going to get an enormous, enormous treat.
And Beowulf isn't very long, but it's a long time ago. The group of Dark Age Scandinavians assaulted night after night by the monster Grendel. As you write, every morning they find more men dead in the mead hall. Tell us the appeal of Beowulf.
Beowulf is just one of the studliest books of all time. It's very short. It's only 70 pages. It has incredible action scenes. It's an expression of an incredibly macho culture. So you read it, and it's just all about how fate will take you, brother. You are a warrior now, but later, age will come in, and grayness of hair, and dimness of eye, and then you will be taken. It's just macho. And you read it, and you're like, wow, our blood has thinned a little bit since then.
Okay, well, we'll give it a try. Milton's Paradise Lost, because as you say, Milton's epic tale of Satan's rebellion, the creation of the world, the fall of man, and his deliverance by Christ, is the greatest single prodigy of a human pen?
If you read it, and it takes a while, and if you understand what Milton is doing with his poetry, with the setup, with the religious sentiments behind the poem, you see it's just a staggering achievement. The writing is so powerful. The story is so meaningful. Satan is often confused to be the hero because he's portrayed so sympathetically.
Well, we have a reading of some of Satan's most famous lines from Milton's Paradise Lost. Let's listen.
The mind is its own place, and in itself can make a heaven of hell a hell of heaven. What matter where, if I be still the same, and what I should be all but less than he whom thunder hath made greater? Here, at least, we shall be free. The Almighty hath not built here for his envy, will not drive us hence. Here we may reign secure, and in my choice to reign is worth ambition, though in hell. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven.
But at the end of the day, what Milton wants to say is, we all have many, many tendencies that would make us recreate either Satan's fall or Adam and Eve's fall, and we need to be reminded that those are not the things that you do to get yourself to heaven, and that true piety comes in a different form. It comes in selflessness. It comes in lack of ego. Of course, he was about as egotistic as any human being on the planet. So,
well, in fact, that's really an interesting tidbit there. You write, in the history of man, John Milton might well have been the biggest jerk.
Well, this is the thing. You might really despise Milton, and you might even despise sort of the ideology behind the poem, but nonetheless, it's going to impress you at every turn, and that's one of the most incredible things about it, to see his fervor, the force of his piety, the strength of his arguments, and just the absolute captivating storyline. You can't help but be blown away.
And by the way, why was he such a jerk?
Well, he went blind in his early 20s. He called himself a church of one during the religious controversies of 17th century England, so he clearly didn't think that anybody else knew what they were talking about. He was smarter, more arrogant, and more probably uptight than, perhaps anybody of his century.
We mentioned Paradise Lost. You feel it's the greatest single prodigy of a human pen. But as you say, some say Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace is just the world's greatest novel, period. But it looks like half a loaf of pumpernickel and weighs about twice as much. How do you make your way through War and Peace?
Oh, rapturously. Honestly, it's not that hard to read. There are a few sections that are a little tedious, some stuff on theory of history and maybe a little bit too much detail about some of the battles, although some of them are incredible. But ultimately, what you see with both Anna Karenina and War and Peace is that Tolstoy is pretty easygoing. He's never obscure. The language is never that difficult. But it's just a steady, slow, rapturous process reading him. And what War and Peace does more than any other novel is have its characters transform, have its characters develop spiritual epiphanies, and to be able to go along with that process and feel them in their full weight is really an incredible thing.
Chuck Murnaghan. Some of his other great book recommendations: Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre, Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, Toni Morrison's Beloved. After the break, get a highlighter. We'll have tips on reading the classics. And later today, why can't Americans know if big coal lobbyists are visiting the Obama White House? Didn't Democrats cry foul when Dick Cheney kept his visitor logs secret? That's later. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. We're speaking with Jack Murnaghan, author of Beowulf on the Beach, His Guide to Making Great Literature Enjoyable. Among the books he recommends, James Joyce's Ulysses, Marcel Proust's Remembrance of Things Past, Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. Jack Murnaghan, you write, though some say that War and Peace is the single greatest novel ever written, your vote would be for Herman Melville's Moby Dick.
Love Moby Dick.
And you say it's funny.
It's tragic that people don't seem to realize this, but I dare you all, just read any one page of Moby Dick, especially the first one. Read anywhere, and you'll find that Ishmael is just having a good time.
Whenever I find myself growing grim about the mouth, whenever it is a damp, drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses and bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet, and especially whenever my hypos get such an upper hand of me that it requires a strong moral principle to prevent me from deliberately stepping into the street and methodically knocking off people's hats, then I account it high time to get to the sea as soon as I can.
He's very, very tongue-in-cheek. He's very playful. And there's an overriding sense of sort of joy and play and lightness and levity that accompanies like the deep philosophy and the great adventure story and all the spiritual meanings of Moby Dick.
Then there's 100 Years of Solitude. Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Here's a little of the beginning.
Many years later, as he faced the firing squad, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was to remember that distant afternoon when his father took him to discover ice. At that time, Moconato was a village of 20 adobe houses, built on the bank of a river of clear water that ran along a bed of polished stones which were white and enormous, like prehistoric eggs. The world was so recent that many things lacked names, and in order to indicate them, it was necessary to point.
Here you just seem to not be able to find the words to say how great you think this book is, a novel that arches above and beyond all others, covering them in its eclipse like a sequoia does a sapling. This book reaches me where I zip, where I button a shirt, where I put on a hat. There's no book that can teach us more. Why?
Oh, because it's just so full of humanity and so full of life and wisdom. Its characters are incredibly deep and incredibly moving, and just even though they all share the same names, they have a really profound range. So you'll find people in such a range of human situations responding at the deepest level of feeling and wisdom. I just think that it's an incredible document about being alive and being a human being.
You close the book with tips on reading classics. Give us a few.
First of all, I think you should read slowly. Not fast, no speed reading, and try not to let a sentence go by without really focusing on it as much as you can. They won't always make sense, not every sentence, especially in someone like Joyce. But it's amazing if you don't let yourself skim at any point or let your attention waver, you suddenly find yourself getting an enormous amount more out of a book.
So when reading Pride and Prejudice or the Old and New Testaments, take your time.
Yes, take your time, bring a pen. You might not want to have to read the Old Testament too many times, so you should underline your favorite parts so you can go back and find them again.
Also on the list, watch for irony, humor, puns, turns of phrase. Puns are hard to find in, for instance, Canterbury Tales, but they're there.
They're definitely there. No, and as are wonderful things like, answers to crossword puzzle questions, Scrabble words. You know, there's a lot that you can pick up incidentally if you read slowly and pay attention and maybe keep notes on the side.
And you say pick the right edition. How do we know?
First of all, it's important to be careful about taking editions from online because normally they're public domain. There are often translations that are out of date, and that can really be a disaster with foreign texts. If you're going to have, a Shakespeare, you want the notes to be at the bottom of the page instead of at the end so that they're really accessible. But at the same time, you don't want them to be too academic because, you know, that's just going to become cumbersome and get in the way. So, you know, just look around, see what feels right. And at the end of the day, you're going to be the best arbiter of what you need. And you're going to even be the best arbiter of what's the best translation. If a given paragraph reads really well to you and feels really good, then that's the translation you should read, even if there's a newer one or a more famous one out there. Yeah.
So, Jack, there are 50. I'm looking. The Fairy Queen, Faust 1 and 2, Bleak House, To the Lighthouse. Pick five.
The five that I think you're going to get the most out of would be 100 Years of Solitude, War and Peace, Moby Dick, Bleak House, and Paradise Lost.
Well, and that should take you...
That will take a good solid year.
Right, right. The whole year. That's author Jack Murnaghan. His book is Beowulf on the Beach, What to Love and What to Skip in Literature's 50 Greatest Hits. Jack, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin. I appreciate it.
Let's just take a second to squeeze in a few of your comments and corrections. Yesterday, in discussing the missing Air France Flight 447, we said its black boxes were 10 miles under the Atlantic. Well, Robert Lee writes, the deepest part of the ocean is only 7 miles, and that's in the Pacific. And Mark Havens of Lewiston, Idaho adds, I think the Air France boxes are 2 to 3 miles under the sea, but what a shame they can't be found. We also spoke about lawsuits against the federal government's Defense of Marriage Act with a postal worker in a same-sex marriage and an official of the gay and lesbian group GLAAD. Now, they are suing the government, as is the state of Massachusetts, because the federal law denies legally married same-sex couples federal benefits like health care for spouses, even if they're raising a family. Well, George Shaw of Santa Barbara, California, felt we should have had a voice in opposition to same-sex marriage. He writes, "One can be sympathetic to appeals for equal rights at the same time one believes that children need to be raised by a mother and father, and that trumps, as it must, the rights of same-sex couples." By the way, we'll link you at our website to another recent story with author Jeremy Adam Smith. His book is called The Daddy Shift, and in it he cites research from the American Psychological Association that says that gay parents are raising healthy kids and that all kids don't need a traditional parent as much as they need a support system of adults who love them. We'd love to hear from you. Go to hearnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email or call, or leave a comment right there on the homepage. And Monday on Here and Now, confirmation hearings begin for Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. It's on our watch, so we'll bring it to you. That's Monday. Still ahead today, the story of baseball great Satchel Paige. Back after the news, Here and Now. Is it cyber war? That's what computer experts are asking. On July 4th, a botnet was activated. That's a network of tens of thousands of computers worldwide, hijacked by a computer worm so that they become sort of zombies. They began bombarding websites in South Korea and in the U.S., including the Treasury Department, the Pentagon, and the White House, crashing websites. Apparently, no major damage has been done, but some sites in South Korea are still down. Officials in the U.S. and South Korea say the attacks appear to have been launched from inside North Korea. Ira Winkler is president of Internet Security Advisors Group, a former analyst with the National Security Agency, and author of the book Spies Among Us. So, Ira, your thoughts. Is this cyber war?
Frankly, it could be. I really think that's an irrelevant question, because if it is, it's one-sided, because I don't think we'd retaliate. It's such a poor attempt at a cyber warfare attack, though, that it really, I mean, it seems more like an imbecile is doing this than a national government.
Well, why? Why isn't this, in your opinion, a sophisticated enough attack?
Well, just for example, it was launched on July 4th. Very symbolic in theory. However, the problem is that why attack the U.S. government websites on July 4th when nobody's going to be looking at them, which is on a Saturday as well, which means you can see where the damage is coming from and start mitigating the damage by the time you need the sites up on Monday morning. So that's a very poorly planned out attack. And, you know, attacking websites, you know, it's like, gee, the National Security Agency website was attacked. Big deal. They don't do anything with it. There's hundreds of other operational systems you could have attacked that would have had a serious effect on operations in the United States and South Korea, although they are attacking some South Korean banks, but that means it's like you can't get at your account over the Internet. You can still walk into the banks and do what you want.
Well, so it's not as sophisticated to sort of, you seem to be sniffing in disdain at this attack. But you also say that Internet service providers can stop these attacks, and they should. Now, some would say, isn't that hard to do? It's such a vast, you know, it feels as like the sea to us.
Yeah, well, frankly, no. Let me use an analogy. You know, let's use cars. Let's say somebody says, we want to cripple New York City by driving in millions of Yugos to New York City. And so you can't get over the bridges and through the tunnels because we'll just block them. Well, let's say a police officer in Gatlinburg, Tennessee says, wow, where are all those Yugos coming from? They're coming from that factory over here in Gatlinburg. Well, we can't stop them because it's a public road. Then you see something similar in, like, coming out of Toronto. And then you see something similar coming out of Boise, Idaho. You know, it's easier for the people in Boise, Idaho, Toronto, and Gatlinburg, Tennessee to stop it at the source than to let it go, because this is not normal traffic. This is a couple of systems that are spewing out basically garbage data, a very specific type of message that's, you know, that's basic to the Internet, but you shouldn't see millions of them coming at a single computer, so it's relatively easy to start. And you can also see these type of packets going across the Internet, and they're called data packets, and you can see them, and you can stop them if you have the will to do so.
And what are you saying? There ought to be a law if there's not the will?
Well, normally, you would think that this would be good practice because, just for example, the roads of Tennessee would be flooded with all these Yugos coming out of
right.
it, and it impedes the Tennessee roads. Likewise, it impedes the Internet service providers that are facilitating this traffic going across.
So it should be in their own self-interest to do this.
Right, but they don't want to take any responsibility for something that they have no responsibility for. It's putting a burden on them, in theory, that they otherwise wouldn't have. And most industries, as you know, just hate regulations. And finally, when something pops up like this, they say, oh, don't worry, we'll try to do something about it. We'll self-regulate. And, you know, they've been saying that for two decades now, so.
Well, I'm smelling that's the direction you might want to go in. That's Ira Winkler, president of Internet Security Advisors Group, also a former analyst with the National Security Agency. And just, we have 10 seconds, Ira, but if it's not North Korea, could it be a kid sitting in his bedroom in some other country?
Odds are it is a kid sitting in his bedroom, possibly even in the United States, but more likely in, well, actually, I doubt it's North Korea, because North Korea
right.
is very controlled.
Right. Ira, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a 30-second break and come back with a look at the Obama administration's transparency here and now. The first memorandum that Barack Obama signed as president was to address what he called too much secrecy. It was aimed at achieving, quote, unprecedented levels of openness in government. And this month, the White House launched a website and blog to solicit public opinion on how to change the way the federal government classifies documents. But critics are charging that all this has amounted to is change you can't access because, they say, too often the Obama administration has adopted the same legal arguments as the Bush administration. Ann Weissman is one of those critics. She's chief counsel for Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW. And we know that specifically you're unhappy with the Obama White House's refusal to release visitor logs. But first, give us your overall thoughts on this Bush-Obama comparison.
Well, I think, unfortunately, the comparison so far works much better than we would have hoped. Certainly based on the campaign promises of President Obama, the memoranda that you referred to that he issued on his first full day in office, we expected that we were going to see a really radical shift. And so far, our experience, unfortunately, has been to the contrary, that in case after case, President Obama and his administration are carrying on the same policies that the Bush administration carried on with respect to secrecy in the White House and in his administration.
Well, a couple things. Michael Isikoff, writing in Newsweek, points out that memorandum that we're both speaking of that called for transparency had a clause that people aren't noticing, which said that there should be transparency except when a case might involve pending litigation. As you well know, there is a lawsuit pending against the Bush administration for withholding their visitor logs. CREW, your organization, brought that lawsuit. So can't the White House say, you know, our records might be involved in that case as well, and so we must withhold them?
Well, the answer to that question is actually no, because that lawsuit is limited to the visitor logs and records of visits to the Bush White House. We have, however, now filed a new lawsuit, this time asking for visits by coal executives to the White House. And the Obama administration, in response, denied our request, taking the very same position that the Bush administration had, that is, that these are presidential, not agency records, and otherwise can't be disclosed to the public.
And to remind ourselves, the Bush-era controversy stems from an attempt to see if oil energy executives visited the Bush White House. And as you said, you're now interested in coal company executive visits to the current White House. Well, when we spoke about these issues during the Bush administration, every expert we talked to said, there is no president in the world that's going to give up executive power. In other words, if one administration, the Bush administration, claimed this power to hold on to White House logs in particular, the next president is not going to give it up.
And this is a concern we had from the outset. And as you pointed out, I mean, there's an incredible irony here. which is that the Bush administration was criticized, including by then-Senator Obama, for the secret meetings that they had with energy officials in formulating their energy policy. And now we have that same individual who's now president refusing to tell us who he and his staff are meeting with regards to their energy policy and clean coal.
Well, we spoke recently with James Meek of the Daily News in New York. He successfully received transcripts of interrogations of Saddam Hussein. Now, supporters of Obama point to that as true transparency.
I'm not suggesting that on no level is this president transparent. As you started out by saying, they've taken advantage of a lot of the new technologies to try to open government up. Unfortunately, though, what we are seeing is that a lot of their transparency seems to be of their own choosing, and on issues that I think really go to the heart of what it means to be a transparent administration, they're really dropping the ball. I mean, I think the thing about visitor logs, the imagery there, I think is really quite powerful. It's the equivalent of sort of building a wall around the White House by saying, you know, on the one hand, we're transparent, but we will not tell you anyone who enters the White House for any purpose whatsoever.
Well, withholding Secret Service visitor logs is not the only area in which the Obama White House has taken a position similar to the Bush White House on transparency. Another important case involves the FBI interview with Dick Cheney about the leaking of CIA agent Valerie Plame's identity. Just fill us in a little on that.
It all started when Congressman Waxman, who was then head of the House Oversight Committee, asked the Attorney General for the transcript of that interview, as well as the interview that the president had given the FBI, and the Attorney General, then Attorney General Mukasey, refused to turn over the interviews. We followed up with a Freedom of Information Act request for the interview of the vice president, and not surprisingly, the Department of Justice took the position that the public was not entitled to any of it. And then the new administration came in, and it seemed to us that this really was a prime case where they could and should, you know, change course and agree to make the transcript available to the public, and they have not. And it was really interesting, in a recent court hearing, the judge was almost incredulous and questioned Department of Justice lawyers as to whether or not the new administration had really considered the position they were taking, and was reassured that, yes, the change of administrations made no change in their position.
And the Obama Justice Department filed a memo just last week saying that to release the interview of Dick Cheney by the FBI would cause public officials not to cooperate with criminal investigations in the future.
I think that's really extraordinary, because what they're saying is that future White House officials will be unwilling to cooperate with a legitimate law enforcement investigation. And I think on its face, that's an astounding proposition.
Shouldn't there be some ability to keep a conversation confidential for national security?
Absolutely, and there is. Let me be clear. I certainly recognize that the president deserves privacy, both in conducting his business of state, that there are times when he needs confidentiality, and in his private affairs. But he is, after all, an elected official. And generally speaking, I think the public has a right to know what he is up to.
Are you surprised that the Obama White House is seeming to walk lockstep with the Bush administration on this issue?
Yes, I am surprised, because it's such a disconnect with their stated policies and promises that they have made. We hope that it's still early enough in the administration that they can reverse course. We hope they will. But we are surprised and deeply disappointed.
That's Anne Weissman, Chief Counsel for CREW, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Monday on Here and Now, you say you're trying to wean yourself off bottled water to go back to the tap. We'll tell you how to find out how safe your water is. And by the way, did you know the biggest selling bottled waters are from a tap? That's Monday. Back in a minute with a great baseball story about a baseball great, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. Next Tuesday, President Obama will throw out the first pitch at the Major League Baseball All-Star Game in St. Louis. One wonders if Leroy Satchel Paige ever imagined there would be such a moment. After all, when Paige was in his prime as a ballplayer, as the brightest star in the Negro Leagues in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, Major League Baseball had a color barrier. It was whites only. That finally changed in 1947. Satchel Paige was in his 40s when Jackie Robinson made his debut with the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947. By then, Paige had 20 years of pitching on his slingshot-like right arm. He did finally make it to the big leagues in 1948 when he signed with the Cleveland Indians, but his major league career was limited to parts of just six seasons. Still, in 1971, Paige was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York, the first player honored for his outstanding play in the Negro Leagues rather than the major leagues.
And so I guess all that got me up here to Cooperstown, somewhere that I didn't have any dreams back when I come in baseball of getting. But the little poem I wrote about Don't Never Look Back, Something May Be Gaining on You, that kept me going.
Satchel Paige, who died in 1982. Journalist Larry Tye is out with a terrific new book about Satchel Paige. It's called Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock spoke with Larry before a recent book signing at the Historical Society in Lexington, Massachusetts. Alex asked him if there was a connection between this book and his earlier book about the Pullman Porters, the African-American railroad men.
One of the places that I became intrigued about Satchel Paige, I grew up hearing about him from my father every time we went to a Red Sox game, and realized that he, like most people, only knew an inch deep of Satchel Paige. And I got an inch or deeper than that when I spent a year and a half traveling around the country talking to aging Pullman porters who had served Satchel when he would ride the trains with his teams, particularly in his later days in the major leagues, and who adored Satchel. He may have been, at that time, the most venerated black man in America, partly because he was such a great athlete, and partly because he was such a sensational showman and a proud figure.
What made him so special as a pitcher?
He had two things that were quite extraordinary. One was he threw the ball so fast and hard that his catchers would have to put a beefsteak between their hand and the baseball glove so they wouldn't end up with burning hands at the end of the game. He threw it with such accuracy that he'd go out before the game and throw 10 out of 10 pitches over a postage stamp that he would put down on home plate. The idea of combining speed like that with control like that, with durability to last 40 years, is something that baseball fans will argue from here till the end of the millennium over who the best pitcher of all times was. There is no question that the best pitcher for the longest time was Satchel Paige.
He was very good at creating his own legend as well, wasn't he? You talked about the throwing the ball over the postage stamp on the stamp on the plate. He said, I think I could take the frosting off a cake with my fastball. He was very good at creating himself as a sort of a legend in his own time.
He was in two ways. One is he was eloquent, and he said things like what you just said. He said his most famous statement that got him into Bartlett's Book of Quotations was, don't look back, something might be gaining on you. So he was eloquent. He had the facts and the performance to back up his boasts, and he needed to fan his legend in a way that guys like Babe Ruth and Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams didn't. Satchel was black. He was playing for his prime years in the shadows of the Negro League, this racially segregated world of baseball that few reporters and not nearly as many fans as were watching the major leagues were out there. And so he had to create a little bit of mystery, do a tiny bit of embellishment, to make people realize that he was on par with these great white stars who reporters created a legend for.
Remind our listeners just how important the Negro Leagues were in the black community, how big a deal it was for them to go see a pitcher like Satchel Paige.
If I could, I'd like you to take you to a Sunday Negro Leagues game in cities all across America. It was a time when women got out their best shoes, put on their mink stoles, spent a week preparing their hair. Men took out their patent leather shoes and their straw hats. ministers let church out early, not just so the congregants could make it to the baseball game, but so they could make it. And every big Sunday baseball game featured Satchel Paige. This was black society. It was the one time during the week where African Americans could let down their hair, really put aside all the slights that they had to suffer the rest of the week, and just be themselves with their friends and their neighbors and watch wonderful, hard-edged baseball.
Why wasn't Satchel Paige the black ball player that crossed the color line? Why was it Jackie Robinson? It seems like Satchel Paige would have been, he was there, he certainly was talented enough. Why wasn't it him?
He asked that question of himself. When the announcement was made that Jackie was signed in 1945 by Branch Rickey to break the color barrier, Satchel started out with a perfect PC answer. He said, Jackie was the right guy, you couldn't have picked a better guy. When he said that, my guess is he was having an ulcer, because that was not what he felt. And what he said later on was, I'm the guy who got all these people looking at the Negro Leagues, I'm the guy who got all these people looking at my Kansas City Monarchs team and their second string second baseman Jackie Robinson. I'm the guy that ought to have been first.
We're in Red Sox territory, obviously, here in Massachusetts, and he pitched his last game in the major leagues against the Red Sox. He was pitching for the Kansas City Athletics. This was in 1965, I believe. Charlie Finley had signed him kind of as a publicity stunt, I guess, to bring in some fans. Tell us a little bit about that final game.
So Satchel was set up in the bullpen with a rocking chair, with a nurse in a white uniform, and with his personal water boy. And it was all part of Charlie Finley was a great showman, and he had a show here. He thought Satchel would come in, he'd get bombed, but he had filled up the stands, people were there to see Satchel, and Satchel, as always, never disappointed. He was 59 years old, which was exactly 30 years older than his catcher that night, and even his teammates were saying, this guy belongs in a nursing home, not out here on the diamond. So he goes out, he pitches against a Red Sox team where the only guy to get a hit was Carl Yastrzemski, shuts them out in three innings, comes back onto the field afterwards, they dim the lights, they play, and everybody sings that old gray mare, and in tribute to him, all these tens of thousands of fans flick on matches and lighters to basically say, we love you, Satchel.
In the end, Larry Ty, what do you think Satchel Paige's legacy is? What is his place, or where is his place in the pantheon of American sports heroes or American legends?
In sports heroes, he is the longest-lasting great pitcher in the history of baseball. And in the history of America, starting with a presumption, which I think is true, that baseball integrated before any other major institution in American society, Satchel Paige played a bigger role than anybody but Jackie Robinson, and maybe than Jackie Robinson, in integrating this sport. If Jackie was the father of baseball integration, Satchel was undoubtedly the grandfather.
Larry Tye's book is Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. He spoke with Here and Now's Alex Ashlock. For more, visit our website, hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.